to the CCFR Radio Podcast, your source for news, updates, and stories from the CCFR.
Hey, everybody. Welcome to episode 22 of the CCFR Radio Podcast. I'm your host, Rod Giltaka. Thanks for joining me again today on the show. We'll have a look at the bizarre behavior of both federal and municipal politicians in the face of daily criminal shootings in Toronto, and also an interview with emergency medicine physician and competitive shooter, Dr. Adrian Robertson. Really glad to have him on. All that and more right after this. Hey everybody, it's Rod Giltaka from the Canadian Coalition for Firearm Rights. We get a lot of people in our Facebook group asking about gun laws and regulations, and there's always a wide variety of answers to be had. But what if you had the ability to ask any legal question, whether about guns or not, and have an actual lawyer answer it? You can have a resource like that for $16 a year with the CCFR's Legal Advice Plan. No joke, man, $16 gets you unlimited legal advice over the phone when you need it from a certified, fully qualified lawyer. Don't take a chance by acting on unreliable advice when it comes to the law. You can buy this plan by clicking on the insurance tab at www.firearmrights.ca, and you're helping fund the CCFR at the same time. It's a great way to get solid advice when you need it and join in the fight for your own ability to own and use firearms. Once again, click the insurance tab at firearmrights.ca, and thank you for your support. All right, welcome back, everybody. I just wanted to play a couple of clips. It's kind of interesting, some stuff that's going on. Unfortunately, for the people of Toronto, there's a shooting epidemic happening right now, all gang related. And you have all of the stakeholders, I guess, if you will. You have the mayor talking about it. Some city councilors, I'm sure, are talking about it as well. And of course, it has this relationship with our federal government in what they're trying to do as well. But I think the reason why I wanted to play these clips for you is what's very interesting is their assessment of what the problem is and how it contrasts or contradicts really what they're doing legislatively, what they're trying to do to stop the violence. So there's this admission that they understand how this all works, and then they do something completely different that has nothing to do with what their problem is. It's very interesting. So here's the mayor of Toronto.
What's going on here?
One of the reasons why we have to get together as three governments and as the police service to talk about these things is because it does require multiple efforts on the part of multiple governments and agencies. And so you look at the justice system, and it doesn't take that long, quite frankly, in my view anyway, to issue changed guidelines to the Crown attorneys to say, very simply, that those who are on bail already and who are found in possession of a handgun or committing a crime with a handgun, those who've been convicted previously of a handgun offense who are found in possession of a handgun should not be given bail.
So the mayor looking for some changes. We also heard from Premier...
All right, it's okay, folks. Bill C-71 is on the way. Promise fulfilled. We're gonna make Rod Giltaka get a separate ATT when he's taking his firearm, his restricted firearm, to the gunsmith. Problem solved. It's okay, just like we promise. Maybe we'll even make sure that there's a transaction record between Rod Giltaka and Mike Loberg when they exchange a firearm, both of them being licensed individuals. Gang issue averted. All right. Good work, everybody. Now, check this out. In sharp contrast to what legislatively they're doing, you know, these people do understand what the reality is. Check out this professor or what have you from University of Toronto.
To consider the reasons for this spate of deadly shootings and what can be done about it, I'm joined by Professor Ju-Young Lee. He's a sociologist at the University of Toronto. So, Ju-Young, what could explain, what do you think explains this surge in gun violence in Toronto?
So there are many number of different things that could explain this recent spate of shootings. As the police chief and the mayor have mentioned, this could be related to intermittent gang conflicts that are now bubbling over into lethal shootouts. It might also indicate that there are more firearms on the streets. So some interesting data from the Toronto Police. In 2014, there were 180 gun occurrences, which the police define as incidents where a person discharges a firearm and shoots it at somebody else. This year in 2018, we're already at 200 recorded such occurrences. So we're quickly outpacing the number that we saw just a few years ago. And this is a trend that we've seen over the last couple years. So one defensible hypothesis, I think, and I'm saying this very delicately, is that there might be more firearms on the streets and that young people who are at risk might have more access to them.
Yeah, that is a very interesting point. People, they're looking to the mayor, to John Tory, to try and find solutions to all this and to the police, obviously. But he's saying that there's not going to be a magic wand fix. What do you make of that?
I mean, I agree with the sentiment of that. There isn't really a magic wand fix. But I can tell you that one solution that will not yield long-term positive results is just getting tough on crime. So often in the aftermath of shootings, particularly when they happen in places where people don't expect them to occur, there's this knee-jerk response to sort of send in police officers and start arresting people. There's talks about bringing back the TAVIS program, where police will stop youth of color on the streets and ask them about their potential ties to gangs and so forth. These kinds of measures can sometimes lead to short-term drops in crime rates, but they're not addressing the root causes. And so that's why they don't really work in the long run. So I think that in the long run, the city should be thinking about trying to eliminate the core conditions that are, driving young people into gangs, drug dealing, and other kinds of activities that increase their risks of being an offender or a victim of gun violence.
And so tell me about that. What are those core problems or core challenges?
So the biggest indicators that we have are concentrated intergenerational poverty in disadvantaged neighborhoods, racial exclusion from the labor market and from key institutions like higher education that can give at-risk youth a chance to get ahead in the world. These are the kinds of things that, draw young people into activities and situations that increase their risks. The journalist David Simon, who wrote The Wire, has this great quote where he says, "The street corner is always hiring." And, if you're a young person of color coming of age in a place where you don't see a lot of opportunities in front of you, you don't have people who are necessarily always helping you get a good job and so forth, then these kinds of illicit activities become much more attractive by comparison. And so if we want to really long-term reduce gun violence, we should be building a society that shields at-risk youth of color, Black Canadians, Indigenous youth, from getting involved in these kinds of activities. And I should say that there are a lot of community groups out there now who are already doing this work, and the government should be supporting mm-hmm. them as well.
Drew Young, it was interesting talking to you today. Thank you.
Okay, so Mr. Lee goes down the same path as anyone that has never thought this topic really through very clearly, which is, well, there must be more guns. That's why people are shooting each other. And it's not controversial, and it's certainly not a stretch for me to say the determining factor on whether someone's going to shoot another person isn't the fact that they have access to firearms. I've got tons of firearms, and I've never pointed a live firearm at another human being. And why haven't I done that? Because it's actually against the law. It's a charge called pointing a firearm, and it comes with some very significant criminal sanctions. So, this is usually the first go-to for people that haven't thought it through. And for somebody that's a sociologist, I would imagine that he would have thought these comments through before he went on the air. But, you can be led down a path where you're wondering, how did I get here? I've been down that path myself. So eventually he does think it through, and he comes to the actual correct answer, which is it is poverty, unemployment, and lack of opportunity and lack of hope that cause people to live a high-risk lifestyle, to get involved in illicit activity involving drugs and other criminal activity. Done. Where have you heard that before? This is not new news, and I think this is why I find this actually particularly frustrating, is everybody knows this. This guy knows it, the mayor, John Tory. Anyway, whatever. He knows it at some level. and certainly Goodale knows it, and Holland knows it, and Fraggle Rockus and the rest of these individuals, I'll use that term just to keep the niceties going. They all know this stuff. In fact, when it comes to what's the reason for violence, including violence involving firearms, poverty, unemployment, lack of opportunity, lack of hope, I did a video on the Civil Advantage channel like 2 years, and I was using material that I had learned from probably a decade before. Well, not quite a decade, but probably 8 years before to come to that same conclusion. But again, boom, here's Bill C-71, has nothing to do with any of this stuff, has everything to do with making sure that people like me are kept under the thumb, right? Kept underfoot. That's what it is. And they wonder why we don't like the bill. It's a complex topic, but it's really not that complex. So anyway, I thought you might find that interesting. All right. So what I want to end up this the segment with is just I want to talk about a couple of emails that I've gotten. So when someone sends me an email, I have no way to know whether any of it's true or they're who they say they are. And I'm just stating a reality, but I always take it at face value. So I'm going to tell you about these emails and just give you a little bit of commentary on this because I think it's important and I think it's something that a lot of people miss. And I think in the back of my head, I'm hoping that someone that knows some of the offenders of the behavior that I'm going to talk about actually hear this and go, yeah, that is a problem. And I'm going to talk to my boss or my colleague about it. So maybe they'll stop doing it because there's some serious consequences. So anyway, I got these emails and I'm just going to take them at face value that they are 100% accurate. And if not, that's okay because I'm going to make the point. I'll use them to make my point. Now, what I want to discuss is the impact or the consequences of bad behavior in the political class and in the media. When you have people, you know, very limited individuals, let's say like Peter Fragilorakis, who just by his behavior illustrates to me, he doesn't care about the consequences of what he does. He doesn't care about having a conversation or what good legislation looks like. He's there to play a part. And his part is pretty much to get his pension. And I'm just guessing. I have no way to know the real motivations of a Fragilorakis or a Mark Holland. But he's there to stay in power and to further his political career. Now, the pension isn't that good. I've looked into it. But it's something. It is a pension, and you only have to serve 6 years to get that pension, so that's good. You only have to get in twice. But you know, for whatever their motivations are, they have to do the right thing, because if they don't do the right thing, it damages our society as a whole. It's not just like, yeah, I didn't do a good job on this product that I was making. Some people bought it, you know, stuff happens, whatever. What happens is when you act in a disingenuous nature and you do things that are bad for society and do it all for the wrong reasons, you create instability. What creates instability is a consequence of that bad behavior in that it destroys the relationship between people and the government, and by extension between people and law enforcement. And that relationship is so important. And I know you guys have heard me talk about this before, but that's a very important relationship. And I'm doing everything that I can to preserve that relationship. And that relationship is part of the legitimacy of the government. Now think of it in these terms. Imagine you are a party in an arranged marriage. And I'm using that analogy only because that's the only analogy I can come up with. So you didn't have a choice in partner. You've been pushed together. You're saying you guys are going to have a partnership. And me as a well-meaning person say, well, I'll be a big enough person for both of us to make sure that this relationship works, because that's my, you know, that's my obligation right now, is to make sure this works. Well, imagine that partner is now abusive, and they're like, well, they blame you for things you've never done. And they want you to atone for these things. And they take your stuff and they say, well, I'm revoking this from you because you did this. And I was like, well, I never did that. And imagine that they're physically abusive to you. And at some point, no matter how good of a person you are, and no matter how much you want this relationship to work, at some point you're going to say, listen, you come home again and you hit me again like that, and I'm not only going to hit you, but I'm going to hit you 20 times and 20 times harder, because as that reasonable person that's been taking that abuse for so long in the interest of keeping that relationship going, you're getting so frustrated that your reaction is very well could be disproportionate from whatever it was that set you off in the first place. Now, I know I'm kind of dragging you guys along with me, but just bear with me for a second. That idea is the same idea that happens. It's the same social stress that happens in the relationship between citizens that are overregulated and that are persecuted and prosecuted for things that they don't do. At some point, the way that they look at the government is with a lot less legitimacy than is required for our society to function the way it has for the last 80 years. I know that was a mouthful. That was all off the cuff. Hopefully I did a decent job of communicating that. Now, one of these signs is these emails that I got, and I want to share them with you real quick. I'm trying to make this fast. So somebody writes me, I'm going to call this guy Dave. Mr. Giltaka, I'm a former member of the RCMP and a veteran UN peacekeeper in the war in the former Yugoslavia. I'm also a recent member of the CCFR. A friend of mine forwarded your recent radio podcast outlining the antics of Mark Holland and others in committee. The way in which you folks were treated is abhorrent and unacceptable. And Dave is absolutely right. While I understand and appreciate very much your moderate approach to these buffoons, I think it's time that they get a taste of the approach that they'll face if they continue to marginalize moderate and reasonable representatives like yourself. Thus my email to Mark Holland last evening. So that's really important what I just said there. There are people that are getting frustrated to the point where they're like, yeah, I'm not going to act like Rod and the rest of it. I appreciate it, but I'm not going to act like that anymore because these people clearly are not listening. That is a serious marker. All right, I'm going to skip a whole bunch of stuff. He talks about self-defense as a natural right, which is totally true. What kind of an idiot would think that self-defense is not an absolute right? Anyway, it's a funny world out there. All right, so I'm just going to read you a couple more. he gives me a compliment, which I appreciate. I'm extremely impressed with your calm demeanor in dealing with these bureaucrats like Holland and others. You're a truly classy individual. I think thank you for that, Dave. I'm doing my best. And it says, yet I thought it necessary to illustrate for Holland the people he will eventually have to deal with if he does not respect the approach of reasonable folks like you. And then he sends this letter to Mark Holland, and I'm just going to only read a couple little pieces to this, and you can see what the tone is. I have a question for Mr. Holland. I have a question for you as a citizen of a supposedly free nation. I just listened to a radio podcast provided by the CCFR in which one of their representatives claimed you called the members of our organization thugs in committee. Is this accurate? Because if it is, I intend to make it known to my friends, colleagues, and family members what you disgusting liberals are up to. We live in a free nation where law-abiding people do not answer to the likes of power trips like you. Just so you know, the tail does not wag the dog in this effing country. The people will decide these and other critical issues, not you. So the tone is pretty interesting. And it says kind of really at the end, it says, don't make the mistake of assuming that the silent majority will remain silent much longer. Good day, you tyrant. So anyway, I think you guys see what I'm saying. And I'm just hoping, like I say, maybe in the back of my mind, I'm hoping as somebody that's friends with some of these people says, listen, you know, there was somebody that's part of the apparatus, part of the actual extended government that are even getting, you know, they're so frustrated with your bad behavior that they're even turning on us. You know, we need to really start thinking about this before we just act any way we want willy-nilly, right? So anyway, I just thought I'd share that. I appreciate the the abrasive email, Dave, and I appreciate your service. So anyway, I'm hoping that we can turn this around. So hopefully that wasn't too negative. It's just this is what they forced us into. And I'm not a fan of where that's headed. Anyway, we're going to take a quick break. I'm going to come back with Dr. Robertson, and that'll be a great and enlightening interview, so stay with me.
Over the past 25 years, tens of thousands of Canadians have had their firearms taken by no fault of their own through arbitrary reclassifications, paperwork errors, or senseless prohibitions. The government's perfect vision of Canada does not include you or your firearms. Let Canada's politicians and bureaucrats know they do not have your consent. Stand up for your own ability to own and use firearms by joining the CCFR right now at www.firearmrights.ca.
All right, we're back, and special guest on the Skype with me right now is Dr. Adrian Robertson. Thanks for joining me, Adrian.
It's a pleasure to be with you.
Excellent. Well, now we talked a little bit about before what we would cover in this segment, but I'm going to sort of throw a couple of things out there, and then I'm also going to let you guide it because I think you understand a lot more what needs to be communicated from the perspective of a doctor working in emergency medicine and the interactions that you have. So why don't you tell us a little bit about the types of firearm incidents that you see most in your practice?
Sure. So I work primarily in critical care, but I also do air ambulance as part of my emergency practice. And so I am both seeing patients sort of on the front line through air ambulance and seeing patients that have been critically injured or wounded through firearms injuries, as well as all the other injuries that happen in the world. So the two groups that I see primarily are people that are the victims of gang violence and people that have tried to commit suicide with a firearm. Obviously, I see many other people that have tried to commit suicide, and the number of people that commit suicide, say, by hanging far exceed the number of people that I see attempting suicide by firearm. But there doesn't seem to be much of a focus on rope or on rope control. But there obviously is a huge focus on firearms and firearms-related deaths. When it comes to people actually shooting each other, the vast majority of the people that I've met that have been the victims of violent crime involving shooting very often are either members of a gang or are involved in the illicit drug trade in one way or another. And sometimes that includes being the customer. One of the concepts that we have in both emergency medicine and critical care medicine is something called trauma as a chronic disease. And what that means is it means that somebody who gets significantly traumatized may very well just be a single-time person, or they might live a lifestyle where they're at high risk for future trauma-related injuries and events. People involved in illicit trade, people involved in gangs, are obviously at a very high risk for violence. That's part of the risk of their chosen profession, and they understand it. My job, as well as making them get better from a physical point of view, is to also talk to them about some of the risks of their lifestyle and try and persuade them to look at a different path, of which I've had some surprising successes, actually.
So in your experience, you followed up with people that had been shot in violence, and you're more familiar than most people to the type of life these people are leading. And I guess the bottom line is whether or not they're law-abiding gun owners in that they have a license.
Right. So the people that I'm seeing the vast majority of that are being shot are not law-abiding gun owners at all. If they own firearms, they own firearms illicitly, and they're being shot by people that own firearms illicitly. And the very use of their firearms is a whole other series of crimes. Notwithstanding the illegal use. The problems of gang and gang violence are so complex and so much more important to tackle than say the idea that these are law-abiding citizens is immense. So, you know, unfortunately, we're sitting here right now waiting for Bill C-71 to drop, a bill that sounded like initially that it was going to be targeting gangs and gang culture and some of the gang violence, which includes gun violence, but includes many other kinds of violence as well. And unfortunately, it goes purely after the law-abiding citizen. I have seen an incredibly small number of law-abiding gun-owning citizens being shot, and those that I have seen have been shot either by accident or have been shot by themselves in a suicide attempt. And even most of the suicides that I see by gun are not necessarily the gun owner themselves.
Yeah, and suicide in itself is an interesting topic, because when I first became acquainted with firearms, and you know, there's a long story, we don't need to go over that now, but when I first made the decision that I needed to get into firearms, I needed to own guns, I did do a lot of research. And one of the things that I found was at that time, 70 to 75% of firearms-related deaths were suicides. And for me, I thought, well, That's 1,100 people if you translate that to roughly the number of people in Canada in real terms. I thought, oh, well, that's a lot of people. So I looked at suicides. And at that time, firearms represented the method in around 27% of overall suicides. And I'd been running with that number. Well, this is the interesting part. I've been running with that number ever since, until someone had said a lower number to me. And I can be wrong quite often. So I went to Stats Canada and I found out that number's actually been dropping. And that, I think it was 2016, if I'm not mistaken, it was 14% of suicides are committed by firearm. That's a crazy low number.
So I can't give you sort of independent corroboration of numbers. What I can tell you is that it's been my impression that suicide by firearm has been decreasing. Suicide by firearm is an issue, as all suicide is an issue. Unfortunately, when it's done by firearm, it gets burdened with all the drama and politics of firearms issues, as opposed to the tragedy of suicide and the tragedy of looking after people who are hurting in our society, and that we need to intervene in their lives to improve the quality and improve the situation so that they don't commit suicide. The one thing that I think has clearly helped, and one of the reasons why I am a proponent of good firearm storage laws — I don't necessarily agree with all the laws that we have in Canada or how we've written them — but I think the idea that people that are not authorized to have access to your firearms, in particular your spouse and your children, is a critical part of reducing firearms-related deaths due to suicide. I don't know, and I don't think anybody else knows, that we reduce suicide attempts at all by restricting access to firearms. Suicide rates in other countries where we've made guns more difficult to access, those suicide rates have not dropped. Suicides have just gone up by other methods. Men typically use more violent methods than women do: jumping from a height, jumping in front of a train, driving into a bridge abutment. Unfortunately, when it comes to the use of firearms, makes firearms an attractive method for men that are looking to end their lives. Again, the focus here should not be on firearms. The focus should probably be on how do we prevent suicide. And as I mentioned earlier, I treat far more people that have hung themselves by sometimes t-shirts. I've looked after people that hung themselves with shoelaces. And, you know, we don't put any extra effort taking a look at the use of rope as a method of people ending their lives. That said, restricting access to your firearms to make sure that only you have access to them almost certainly reduces the likelihood that your children or your spouse is going to commit suicide with your firearm. And I think that's a good and healthy thing for our society.
Mm-hmm. Well, I think this is typical in the way that our laws are structured in Canada, whereas if you root around long enough, you'll find some noble intent from somewhere, just absolutely horribly implemented. So, you know, I've seen a couple of different approaches to the safe storage, to incentivize people to store their firearms securely and safely, all the way from saying, well, there's civil remedies if someone somehow gets your gun and does something bad with it. There's all kinds of other alternatives other than saying, you know, we will interpret what safe storage is at the time we encounter it, and we're going to charge you criminally for that thing, whether or not anyone was in danger or not. So it just wasn't implemented very well.
Just on that point, I am not personally aware of any of the people that I've met that have committed suicide by firearm that was not theirs. I am not aware of their, say, parents or the person that they got access to the firearm necessarily being charged. So, you know, even under those conditions, I think there are times that the police stay their hand around what seems like, in some ways, an excessive penalty for somebody that's just lost a child. Mm-hmm. It's probably much more along the lines of how we protect our children from caustic substances underneath the kitchen sink. How do we stop our children from swallowing things that would obstruct their airway as they're younger? We don't have laws around this.
Yeah, it's just public education. Yeah.
We have public education, and I think it's you know, part of our role as part of the gun community to make sure that our members understand that safe storage, irregardless of the law, is a good, safe, healthy practice.
So suicide has been brought up as one of the motivations for Bill C-71, but I think everybody agrees one of the biggest motivations is the criminal shootings. And of course, you know, there's a whole story that goes along with that. But from your perspective, is there, like, what do you think about Bill C-71 from somebody in your profession?
Yeah, I think that the part that concerns me the most is in a time of increasing, you know, fiscal challenges. As you know, we're running massive deficits. As we move through these times, a great number of the provinces are in debt as well. Medical care is becoming increasingly limited. My access to services for people with addiction, my access to services for people that are involved in gang violence are distinctly challenged. And here is a significant amount of money being spent on what look like measures, but that, as you well aware, have no chance of saving a single life or changing the outcome downstream 2 years from now or 3 years from now or 10 years from now. Looking back, I can't imagine any of us saying, C-71 did these things. C-71 is going to cost a lot of money. And is not going to in any way improve the lives of any of the people that we're talking about that are suffering, nor is it going to protect any of the innocents from being harmed in the crossfire of these gang-related injuries. They don't happen often, but they do happen.
Yeah. One more question for you, Adrian. Now you've got the Canadian, you know, I can't remember the name, but the Canadian Federation of Emergency Medicine Physicians, whatever, and they've come out with a very strong anti-gun stance. In fact, they testified for committee on Bill C-71, and they entered a brief. You know, as someone that's part of that community, and knowing full well that that what they're trying to do is not totally in line with reality as far as how to solve the problems that C-71 claims to solve. I mean, how does that, and you don't have to answer this if I'm putting you in a bad spot, but how does that make you feel as somebody that works in that industry?
Well, so obviously I can't speak for any of the organizations. CAPE is the organization that you're referring to. A significant number of physicians are not gun owners. A significant number of physicians are sort of politically fairly progressive, liberal kinds of people. And as being part of that ideology, buy into the idea that the gun is the problem. So I'm not surprised to see the organization come out like that. I think the idea that Minister Goodale had at the beginning that this was going to be based on evidence, I think, was a key piece. The problem is that the idea that the legislation be based on evidence ended with him saying that. And I don't know that anybody's been able to support any of the evidence behind C-71. And I don't think my physician colleagues have been able to bring forward any evidence for C-71. The evidence that does exist actually runs contrary to the substance of C-71. So it's hard to square that circle. What's not hard to see is that Canadians, and many of my, the vast majority of my colleagues are Canadians, have been fed a steady dose of it's the gun, it's the gun, it's the gun. And they do see people come in that have been shot. And when you're trained to see the world as it's the tool, it's the tool, it's the tool, I can see why they end up coming up with that same byline. And, you know, we see it in the media all the time. There's this very distinct bias towards firearms. The very fact that they're calling this a gun crisis, or summer of the gun instead of summer of the gang, or that we have increasing gang problems in Toronto, or worsening gang problems in the Vancouver area are really, you know, really the problem. And it's a matter of perception. It's a matter of spin. So while I think these groups are coming out and saying these things, I don't know that they're saying them from a strictly evidence-based perspective.
Yeah, well, and that's the fight that we're fighting, right? And the CCFR is a public relations organization. That's where we're up against, and we're trying to change these perceptions. And you never know, maybe we'll win some folks over in the process, so that would be great. What I'm going to do is I'm going to wind it up here, Adrian. I really appreciate you taking the time to talk to us and for sticking your head up, right? There's always some element of risk for anyone to publicly talk about firearms, which apparently is Canada's dirty secret. And I really appreciate you doing this.
I'm happy to do it, Rod. If we're not brave enough to speak out about who we are and what's really going on, then we're going to lose our privileges and our rights.
Yeah. Okay. Thanks very much.
Thank you very much.
Hunters and sports shooters have a lot more in common than they think. Politicians and bureaucrats will never stop pushing toward their vision of Canada where only the police and the military have firearms. All gun owners need to stand together. An attack on one is an attack on us all. Let these people know they do not have your consent. Stand up for your own ability to own and use firearms. Donate now or become a member of the CCFR at www.firearmrights.ca.
All right, everybody, that's going to do it for episode 22 of the CCFR Radio Podcast. In closing, this is what I'm going to ask from all of you. We obviously volunteer for the CCFR if you can. Become a member if you're not a member. That's really important. Donate if you have a little extra cash and you want to see us do even more than we're doing. I'd appreciate that. But I just wanted to alert you that we have a new Patreon account at patreon.com/CCFR. So what Patreon is, it allows you to give us a monthly gift. So if you want to give us $10 a month or $5 a month or $20 a month, that would be really great. The monthly donations are actually quite handy for us because we can plan our cash flow a little bit better. And what that allows us to do is to be more effective in how we spend money. So anyway, if you can see your way clear to do that, go ahead. This may be a little bit preemptive because I just got through giving the okay for this project, but basically if you are a Patreon supporter and you're going to support us with $20 a month or over, you're going to be added to a special Facebook group, and I've gotten an agreement from Tracy Wilson. Tracy Wilson and I will actually do a private Facebook Live with all of our $20 per month and over Patreon supporter once a month. So every month we're going to give you guys half an hour where Tracy and I are going to get on Facebook Live and answer your questions and engage in a conversation with you. So if that helps motivate you and you want access to the leadership of the CCFR, please consider being a Patreon supporter at $20 or more per month. You can do that on patreon.com. Thanks again, everybody, for coming back, listening to the podcast and supporting us. We're doing great things this year, and there's a lot more to come. Thanks, and we'll see you next time.
This is another episode of the CCFR Radio Podcast. Remember, if you don't stand up for your own ability to own and use firearms, who will? Join the CCFR or donate right now at www.firearmrights.ca.